Hello, and welcome to this seventh episode of Season 5 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Now, Graham, we've been planning to look at unexplained wealth orders for some time, haven't we?
Yes, Ray, and at last, now is the right time. In fact, you might say, given the news out of America this week, that we've been biding our time.
Oh, dear, you might say that, Graham, but I'm not sure that I would. Although, given the somewhat mysterious finances of the presumably outgoing president, an episode on unexplained wealth might be timely.
Well, unexplained or possibly non-existent, Ray. Mm. Only time will tell.
So let's leave that story, I think, which will play out in its own time, and we'll get on with ours. Where should we start?
Well, I think, Ray, the best place would be with the Criminal Finances Act of 2017.
Mm. An act that introduced a number of changes into UK law that have quite far-reaching consequences.
Like making the failure to prevent the facilitation of tax evasion a corporate offence.
That's easy for you to say, Graham. And extending the reach of disclosure orders as well.
Yep, and there were new rules on information sharing and the introduction of super SARs.
Mm. But from the point of view of this episode, the newly created civil requirement of the unexplained wealth order is primary.
Yes, and I think we should start with a reasonably detailed explanation of what they are and how they work.
And then go on to look at the few cases where they've been used so far.
And maybe you finish with a few thoughts as to how they might evolve in future. And we should also make the point that while this is specific to the UK at the moment, many other jurisdictions are watching closely to see if the law or a variation of it might be useful in their own fight against financial crimes. And of course, one or two have already introduced the same concept in their own countries.
Excellent. Let me begin then with a quick précis of the Act in relation to UWOs, unexplained wealth orders. There are two sections because one's needed to deal with England, Wales and Northern Ireland and the second with Scotland to distinguish between the different and separate legal systems. For our purposes, we can deal with them all together as the intent of the order is the same in both cases.
Excellent. Away you go then.
Chapter 1 of the Act is actually designed to be inserted after Section 362 of the Proceeds of Crime Act of 2002.
OK, which I assume we can read then that it's designed to be a continuation of the content of that Act.
Yes, I think that's a safe assumption. At first, the Act makes clear that only an enforcement authority can apply for one of these orders.
Oh, does that mean that you and I can't apply for one then?
I think that's exactly what it means, Graham.
Okay.
And the application must describe the property in respect of which the order is sought, along with the person who the enforcement authority thinks holds the property. And that person does not have to be in the UK for the order to be granted.
It's quite far-reaching, then.
Well, it can be, yes.
Now, what does the order require the person on whom it is served to do?
Well, a few things, Graham. It requires them to set out how much of the property identified they personally own and how they own it.
OK, I guess that could mean directly or potentially through a trust or other corporate arrangement.
Yeah, I think so. And then they have to explain how they obtained the property. And if it's being held by trustees, for example, they need to provide details of the trust or other arrangement, along with any other specific requirements that are listed in the order.
And will the authorities just accept the recipient's word for this?
Well, what do you think, Graham? No, obviously not. The order is likely to require the recipient to provide documentary evidence as well.
Well, that seems entirely reasonable, Ray. Mm. So what sort of time is allowed for the production of the documents and these explanations?
There's no mandated time limit in the legislation. Each case is dependent on the specifics involved.
And that also makes sense. Now, we've mentioned enforcement authorities more than once, Ray. Does the Act actually make clear who they are?
Yes, it does. Deep breath. They are the NCA, HMRC, the FCA, the SFO and the DPP.
Do you know, that's quite a tricky Scrabble hand.
It certainly is. Shall we talk about who's caught by the scope of the Act?
I think that would be really helpful.
Okay, so the first requirement is to show that the respondent holds the property and that that property has a value greater than £50,000.
Do you know, all things considered, that's quite a low figure.
It is, and it gives the authorities considerable scope to use the orders. The second element is that the High Court, which issues the order, must be satisfied that there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that what we know about the respondent's income and assets is insufficient to account for them having obtained the property identified.
And that also seems entirely reasonable and stops them being used as fishing expeditions.
Yes, although as we know, to our cost, trying to ascertain what is reasonable to explain someone's wealth is not an easy task at the best of times.
Source of wealth. One of the more difficult elements of enhanced due diligence, I think.
It certainly is, and may explain, at least in part, why we haven't seen too many of these orders since they were enabled.
And can they be aimed at anybody at all who might have dubious assets?
Well, no, Graham. There are two categories of people, in fact, that are caught by this Act. The first is politically exposed persons.
Any politically exposed person?
Yes, the Act makes no distinction, for instance, between domestic and foreign PEPs.
Good. And the second category?
Well, this is where there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that the respondent is or has been involved in serious crime. And that isn't just in the UK, but anywhere.
Okay. Now, Ray, I've noticed we're starting to accumulate a few reasonable grounds, quotes, which I suspect are there to try and make the scope as wide as possible, that might also hamper the production of the unexplained wealth order while people try to ensure that their reasonable grounds will pass muster.
Well, that's very true. And it's always going to be harder to meet that standard when the serious crime hasn't happened here in the UK. And by the way, the Act also includes a person who is or was connected with the respondent.
A bit like including relatives and close associates in the PEP definition.
Very similar, yes. And finally, as part of this section, the Act says that the respondent does not have to own the property outright. So it can be a share of a property of which other people also own a part. And it doesn't matter if they held the property before or after the Act came into force, as it applies retrospectively.
Both of those seem entirely sensible as well. And then, Ray, I see there are some helpful definitions in respect of calculating the value of the property around ownership and how one might infer what lawfully obtained and known sources of income means.
Indeed, along with a helpful clause making it clear that a PEP, as referred to in the Act, is taken to be someone who meets the standard UK definition and EU definition as laid out in the relevant legislation.
Yes, along with, I see, an equally helpful definition of determining what, quotes, involvement in a serious crime, unquotes, means.
OK, so that's the process for issuing an order. We should talk now about what happens once the order is issued.
Yes, we should, especially when the respondent fails to comply or is unable to comply with the order.
Let's start with failure to comply.
OK, if the respondent fails to comply with the order within the time frame, the property is then presumed to be recoverable.
OK. But what happens if the respondent does reply, but the information turns out to be a load of rubbish?
Well, then their response must be investigated. If the determination is that the response is honest and properly accounts for the property, the order can be rescinded. If the authorities have placed a freezing order on the property...
To stop the respondent moving it out of the court's jurisdiction, for example.
Exactly. The authorities have 60 days to determine whether to keep the freezing order in place or remove it.
And if they only respond to part of the order?
Well, that's also a failure to comply. An action to recover the property can follow.
And presumably, if the respondent does reply with a complete load of rubbish, they're committing a further offence.
Yes, they are. That covers both knowingly making a false statement or recklessly making a statement that turns out, in whole or in part, to be false.
And is this an imprisonable offence?
Yes, it's a fine and prison of up to 2 years or both, depending on the nature of the conviction.
Now, nature of conviction has a very specific connotation here, doesn't it? Do you want to explain what that means for those who might be interested?
Well, yes, and this applies generally, not just to these. There are two forms of conviction available. There is a summary conviction or a conviction on indictment.
Yes. Now, a UK summary conviction is one that happens in a magistrate's court where you don't elect for trial by jury, and your guilt or innocence is determined by either a judge or a panel of magistrates.
Exactly. And the maximum sentence which the court can hand down is now 12 months, used to be 6 months until fairly recently. Whereas if you elect for trial by jury or you're charged at the outset with an indictable offence, i.e. one that cannot go to a magistrate's court, the trial goes to the Crown Court, where they can hand down much larger sentences, up to and including life imprisonment.
But not for this offence alone.
No, as I said just now, maximum offence is 2 years.
And there's some interesting rules around the uses to which the respondent's statement in response to the UWO can be used, or not, as the case may be.
Yeah, for a start, the response cannot be used in other criminal proceedings if it is deemed to be an honest response.
So they can't later hold those words against you, unless you lie through your teeth, in which case it can be.
Oh yes.
And I believe you can't claim immunity from disclosure using GDPR or some other such privacy legislation, right?
No, you can't. The Act explicitly states that the UWO has effect in spite of any restrictions on the disclosure of information.
OK. The Act then goes on to talk about trusts.
An area in which you've always been interested, Ray.
Well, yes. And it is, in its own way, quite revealing.
Go on.
Well, the Act says where someone is taken to hold property in trust, this includes where the respondent has effective control over the property, where the respondent is a trustee of a settlement in which the property is comprised, or where the person is a beneficiary, actual or potential, to the trust property.
Interesting. And then the Act goes on to explain in more detail the granting of a freezing order, as we just mentioned, to avoid the respondent from frustrating the intention of the UWO by moving the property out of the court's jurisdiction.
An order which, like the UWO itself, must be issued by the High Court.
Serious business. And there are lots of sections, it has to be said, relating to freezing orders so as to cover as many different eventualities as possible. But I think, Ray, they're outside the scope of this podcast to cover in any detail.
Yes, I mean, I agree. I think we've given a flavour which will prove sufficient. It's worth pointing out that if the freezing order causes loss to the respondent and they're subsequently released from the UWO, there is the possibility of claiming compensation for that loss.
Yeah, quite right, really. The Act also talks about what might happen if the property is located abroad. And that broadly consists of sending requests for assistance to the country in which the property is located.
Now, call me a cynic, Graham, but I'm willing to bet that a lot of the countries in which the property might be located might not be the sort of jurisdictions likely to be amenable to those requests for assistance.
I think that's not so much cynical as realistic, Ray.
Well, perhaps so. Then the Act moves on to Scottish law.
Yes, which is broadly similar to the remainder of the UK, save for references to the Scottish Parliament and the specific names of Scottish legal institutions.
OK, so that's the legislation, Graham. Who's it been used against so far?
Right, I guess the most famous case is the one involving Mrs. Hagieva, about whom we've spoken previously, the wife of the now imprisoned former head of the International Bank of Azerbaijan, who is currently serving a prison sentence in Azerbaijan for fraud, embezzlement and misappropriation of funds.
So, bit of a classic then. He was both a PEP and guilty of serious crimes.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, by extrapolation, Mrs. Hagieva is both a relative or close associate of a PEP and connected with someone involved in serious criminal activity.
So the UWOs here, and there were actually two of them, identified £22 million in property which the government sought to possess. Following their grant, Mrs. Hagieva first applied to have the order discharged, which failed, and she was then denied permission to appeal.
She was, however, permission was later granted on the basis that as this was the first ever UWO, it would be helpful for the court to provide guidance around certain aspects of it, as they were still very novel.
But that didn't stop the appeal being dismissed, and the Court of Appeal denying leave to appeal to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's a fairly comprehensive victory.
It hasn't stopped Mrs. Hagieva from applying directly to the Supreme Court for leave to appeal, though.
Yeah, really. I mean, you'd think there must be a point where you might consider stopping the expenditure.
And I can't be the only one wondering where the money to pay all these legal fees is coming from, considering the £22 million under dispute is under a freezing order.
Yeah, it makes you wonder whether there wasn't just that £22 million which was sourced from suspicious activity, although we should be clear that this is merely conjecture and in no way constitutes an accusation of impropriety.
Absolutely. And then there was the Aliyev case, which didn't work out quite so well.
No, the Aliyevs are from Kazakhstan and were related to a now-deceased former senior government official.
So therefore, by extension, they were RCAs.
Yes. In this case, the Aliyevs provided detailed information about the purchase and transfer of properties to an offshore foundation. On appeal, the judge decided that they had provided sufficient information to prove the lawful acquisition of the properties.
Which underlines, although in no way challenging this judgment, how difficult it can be to trace a line of sight from the end point of a series of transactions right back to the original point of acquisition of wealth.
Exactly, Ray. It's possible to put so many transactions between point of origin and point of destination, especially if you can mix in legal funds along the way, to make it extremely difficult to meet the standards required by law to enforce one of these orders.
Although we should make the point again, just to be clear, that this is in no way a comment on the outcome of this particular case.
Not at all.
The NCA has also obtained UWOs in respect of serious criminals operating in the UK now, hasn't it?
Yes, one was against a guy called Mansour Hussain, which resulted in him voluntarily handing over almost £10 million worth of properties.
I have to say, Graham, I think voluntarily is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
Yeah, I can't imagine that can be construed to mean happily.
No.
But it might have been a choice of doing that or running the risk of providing false or misleading statements, which would then bring jail time into play.
Well, I guess we'll never know now. But at least the sight of someone being relieved of £10 million in properties, other assets and cash will send a bit of a shiver down the spine of a few other potentially criminal operations.
Yes, and there is a still ongoing, as far as I know, UWO against an unnamed Northern Irish woman for £3.2 million in assets, alleged to have been generated through links to serious and organised crime.
Indeed. So that pretty much summarises the situation in the UK and the way that it has introduced unexplained wealth orders. Of course, we're not the only country to have them. They're also available in Australia, Colombia, and Ireland as well.
Wow. And for anyone interested, there's some really good research available on the web, including a very detailed review of UWOs in Australia and Ireland by the US Department of Justice.
That's a sizable document, coming in at 845 pages.
Did you just say 845 pages?
Right? I did. I cheated and flicked to the end. but that does include copies of the relevant legislation from both countries and quite a lot of other stuff in the appendices too. I mean, even if people were to read just the executive summary, it would be a worthwhile use of 30 minutes or so of their time. Always supposing they were particularly interested in the subject, as we are.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure at least some of our listeners will be as well.
That wouldn't surprise me at all, Graham. So, what's next for us?
Well, Ray, I've been looking back over our back catalogue, which is quite extensive. And
yeah.
And would you believe we've never properly covered the topic of sanctions?
Wow. Yeah, that is odd, isn't it? But I suspect for all sorts of reasons, there's rarely been a better time to get up to speed with the rules on sanctions.
Right, I think you're absolutely right. What with the UK establishing their post-EU membership approach and the president-elect, as we go to record, in the US reputedly looking at a different approach on Iran, I think we should put together an introduction to sanctions for next time.
I'm looking forward to it.